Welcome to the Patient's Perspective, presented by the Embrace Your Heart Wellness Initiative. I'm your host, Liz Green. Tonight, our discussion focuses on one specific challenge facing women with heart disease, atrial fibrillation. I'm joined with some wonderful guests, Patty Borkowski from Wisconsin, and our main guest, Melanie Truhills from Texas. She is the founder of the American Foundation for Women's Health and has a wonderful patients resource website called stopafib.org. Welcome, ladies, and let's begin our discussion on women living with AFib.
Thank you, Liz.
I'm delighted that you guys could join us today. So, Melanie, let's start right off. I admit I have learned more about atrial fibrillation in the time that we've been friends than I could have guessed that I would learn. But why don't you tell us a little bit about what it is and how would you know that you have it?
Well, atrial fibrillation is one of those really unusual things that you typically know you have it when it actually attacks you. It's an irregular heartbeat. It's the most common irregular heartbeat. And what it is if your heart starts to quiver or you feel like it's starting to, like you have butterflies in your chest or it feels like it's starting to leap out of your chest, that's an indication that you may have atrial fibrillation. If you notice that, you know, your pulse is getting really wild and your heart is racing and palpitations, that's an indication of atrial fibrillation.
And how would you get it diagnosed?
Well, typically, your doctor, if you notice that, you know, you're having these incidents and you ask your doctor about it, your doctor will say, well, let's do an EKG, an electrocardiogram. And that's where they put various leads on these little, you know, these little pads. They stick on you in various places, around a dozen leads, and they will look at, you know, kind of a tracing of your heart. What does the rhythm look like? With that, they may be able to diagnose the atrial fibrillation, but if you're not in AFib at the time, they won't be able to diagnose it. So they may say, well, we'd like for you to wear a Holter monitor or an event monitor. With a Holter monitor, typically you may wear that for a couple of days. That's where the little device is recording. Usually it's about the size of a pager, and you wear it on your belt. And it'll record what your heart rhythm is doing. And it'll record for a day or two. And then you turn that in, and they read it and say, okay, well, here's an episode of AFib, or, you know, we don't really see much AFib.
Mm-hmm.
So the problem, the downside with that is you have to, just like with an EKG, you have to have AFib while you're wearing the monitor. And that's the reason sometimes they'll give you an event monitor. And for that, you usually wear it for 2 to 4 weeks. If you feel something funny, it feels like maybe you're starting into atrial fibrillation, you punch the button, and it actually records what's happening with your heart.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really almost a continuous recording so that when you punch the button, it can go back for 30 to 60 seconds. If there are 2 or 3 incidents of that, then you can put that on your, you know, on the telephone, use the little telephonic feature, and transmit that to your doctor's office. And your doctor can tell, do you have AFib or not? For some people, I'm sorry.
Are there things that would help you bring on an event? I mean, are there things that sort of trigger an AFib event so that you could sort of get it recorded?
Absolutely. Really, with the whole area of what causes AFib and what triggers AFib, we're really in our infancy and learning about it. So the cause is really unknown, but the triggers can be all kinds of things. We're starting to believe that maybe it's a dysfunction of the autonomic nervous system, and maybe there's a genetic component because it seems to run in some families.
Mm.
But it can be related to all kinds of things. It can be brought on by dehydration, by not getting enough liquids, not having enough electrolytes. It can be brought on by nutritional deficiencies. If you're not, you know, getting magnesium, not getting enough potassium, sometimes calcium, that can bring on atrial fibrillation. Can be brought on by other things like drinking coffee or drinking alcohol. Can be brought on in some people by exercising.
Mm.
For other people, it can be run away. You know, basically, it doesn't come on from exercising, but by exercising, you can cause it to go away. So it can vary all across the board. It can be things like just leaning over, maybe leaning over at your desk, leaning over to wash the dog. That can bring on AFib. Things like sleeping on your left side can bring on AFib.
Sleeping on your left side can bring it on?
Yes, sleeping on your left side.
Really?
For many people can bring on AFib.
That's fascinating, because when I was pregnant, because it made the blood flow better.
Right, exactly.
That's really interesting.
Well, because the heart is on the left side of the body, and there's so much that goes on in the left side, things that impact the left side can have a huge impact on the body. So just lifting, you know, just raising your left arm or sleeping on your left side can make a difference. Eating MSG can bring it on for some people. It's really crazy. So there are things like that, that if you start picking up on what are those triggers, if you want to have it diagnosed, you can use those triggers to make sure that it's captured on your EKG. What we're finding is that stress, for a lot of people, can bring on atrial fibrillation. You read in the medical, you know, in health publications about what brings on atrial fibrillation, and rarely do you see mention of stress. And yet, in at least half to two-thirds of the patients that I've spoken with, stress brought it on for them. And I've heard anecdotally that it does for many people. So, you know, just getting under a lot of stress can cause you to have a bout of atrial fibrillation.
Now, was stress a trigger for you?
I don't know that stress was necessarily a trigger for me. For me, it was really wild. I could have, you know, times where I would be leaning over and washing the dog, or I could be leaning over, you know, checking email. I could be, you know, doing all kinds of different things, and all of a sudden, it would just kick in. Never really knew what was going to cause it and what wouldn't, because other times I could be doing those same things and not have it happen. So you never really know. You know, one of the things that I hear AFib patients talking about a lot is that we're all experiments of one. It's rare to find somebody else who has exactly the same combination of things that you do as an AFib patient.
All right. So let's say you get it diagnosed, you know it's a problem. So why is it a problem?
Well, AFib is an issue. Let me actually back up just a little. One of the things that we're also learning is that those who have heart disease seem to be much more at risk of atrial fibrillation. It could be related to high blood pressure, or to diabetes, to obesity, to stress, you know, to a number of the risk factors that can cause heart disease. We're also finding out that those who have respiratory issues like pulmonary and lung disease are also at risk. We're finding that people who have sleep apnea are even more at risk than those who have heart disease.
Really?
And that's because sleep apnea is often related to breathing issues. So you're not getting as much oxygen, and that seems to predispose you to having atrial fibrillation. So in any of those cases, you can have AFib, but we also know that there are people who have no structural heart disease, who have no sleep apnea, but still have atrial fibrillation. And for them, it's perhaps not as risky, but really for anyone that has atrial fibrillation, there are a lot of risk. It really can be an issue. One of the things that's an issue is that when you're having atrial fibrillation, it can overwork the heart. And that can lead to congestive heart failure. Basically, your heart just flat. Only way to solve that is with a heart transplant.
Mm.
Another major problem is the risk of stroke. And from stroke, the risk of death. So, for example, with atrial fibrillation, the upper chambers of the heart tend to be fibrillating or quivering. And that allows blood to pool in the upper chambers. And once those, you know, once that pooling starts to really get going, it can form clots. And then those clots eventually may be launched out to the rest of the body, can go to the brain as a stroke, for example. And so stroke, which is the number three killer, and is also the number one cause of permanent disability, is a huge risk for those who have atrial fibrillation. Mm-hmm. In fact, having atrial fibrillation increases your risk of having a stroke fivefold.
By what?
Five times over.
Oh, my goodness.
So fivefold. And if you have atrial fibrillation, about a third of atrial fibrillation patients will have a stroke at some point in their lives.
That's very important to get it
staggering.
Under control.
Yeah, that is staggering. It's really important to get it under control. And then, you know, just having, things like the body is just starved of oxygen when you have atrial fibrillation. And as a result, it leaves you tired and lethargic, and can also put you at more risk for other heart disease issues. So it can really be a huge problem. In addition to being, a physical problem, it can also have a devastating emotional impact on you as well. So atrial fibrillation is a huge problem. For me, I found that the way I found that I had atrial fibrillation was that one day I was sitting at my desk pulling my email, and all of a sudden my heart felt like it skipped a beat. I started to get real dizzy, and so I thought, I need to go lay down. Well, since I was working from my home office, I just went over and laid down on the sofa in the living room. My husband came over and put on the blood pressure cuff to see what was happening with my blood pressure. And since it was still warm weather, I was wearing shorts, and he noticed that one of my legs was as white as snow. It looked very different, cold. So, bottom line is that I had blood clots. I had a blood clot in my right leg and one behind my right eye. So my right leg was cold, my vision in my right eye was fuzzy. And we went to the emergency room, and in the emergency room they said it was either multiple clots or a single clot that split and went to those two areas. And they said, you almost had a stroke. And I said, what's going on? Why am I having this? And the doctor said, it's due to a condition called atrial fibrillation. So I went home and I started doing the research on it and found out what caused atrial fibrillation found out what triggered atrial fibrillation, and so I started paying close attention to those things. But that was several years ago. We were really had not made nearly as much progress at figuring out some of the things that cause AFib. So, a few weeks later, there I am experiencing a second episode. I was actually out walking the dog, and I was about a half mile or so from home, and all of a sudden, my little heart rate monitor that I wear when I exercise just went screaming up. It went from my normal heart rate to about 270 to 300.
Oh, my.
And, I'm freaking out. I'm thinking, I'm going to pass out right here. What am I going to do? Fortunately, I was carrying my phone. I called my husband. I said, here's where I am. Please come get me. And he came. It felt like my heart was just racing, and felt like it was going to jump out of my chest. He said, it took him maybe 2 minutes max to get there. And to me, it felt like it was at least 10 minutes. Mm. So one of the things that I learned from that was never go anywhere without your cell phone. So I was fortunate that I had a cell phone, but I could easily have been without my cell phone and died right there. So after that, I never even went to the mailbox without carrying my phone with me. Anytime I left the house, I had the phone with me. And that can be really frightening because you're afraid to go anywhere. You're paralyzed. You're fearful. You're scared. And it's not just you, it's your family too.
Sure. Well, I know it had a big impact. You travel for your
Absolutely.
Work. That's what you do.
Absolutely.
So I know it had a big impact on that.
Absolutely. What happened there was that I had an earlier heart incident about 7 months earlier, and and that had happened as I was getting off of an airplane. This AFib incident happened 12 hours after getting off of an airplane. So the doctor said, I don't think you should be flying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was grounded. And so here I was needing to travel all over the country, not able to fly. Fortunately, we had a motorhome, and so my family would just pack up, go with me, and we would travel together to my events where I was speaking about heart disease. That's really a challenge for most families, to just pack up and go with the patient. Even when we were at home, my family was reluctant to meetings that were 30 minutes to an hour away, just really didn't want to let me out of their sight. And so AFib has a huge impact on the patient's life, but also on the family's life as well.
I can only imagine. I know what it was like for us after I had my heart attack. There was a lot of fear. You know, if my husband didn't know where I was, he was very worried about my condition. So knowing that there's a real risk, it's got to be frightening for your family.
Absolutely. And I think that happens with all heart disease patients, regardless of what your condition is. You're scared. Your family's scared. You just don't know, is something else going to happen? And that has a huge impact on you. Eventually, when you come through most heart disease, you start to get more confident that, well, everything's going to be okay. And that's very, very reassuring. Unfortunately for AFib patients, that's not the case, because they never know when another incident's going to happen. Are you going to be in line at the grocery store? Are you going to be out doing just the normal life things and have this happen? It easily can. For instance, I've interviewed a number of atrial fibrillation patients, and I've had patients tell me, well, you know, I had to give up skiing, had to give up snowmobiling, had to give up flying, had to give up the things that I really love to do because I just couldn't trust that I wasn't going to have a stroke right there while I was doing those things, that AFib wasn't going to, you know, come on me during those. So it's really frustrating to have to go through the life-changing aspects of atrial fibrillation, and especially to realize that your doctor doesn't understand what it's doing to you.
Talk a little bit more about that. I know that that's been a real issue for you and something that you work very hard at doing, educating doctors and other healthcare providers about what it's like to have atrial fibrillation.
Absolutely. And I was fortunate. I had a really great doctor that was very understanding. But a lot of patients are not as fortunate. And, you know, one of the stories that I think really captures what goes on between doctor and patient is the story of one of the guys that I interviewed. He said, you know, my doctor's sitting there and saying, you really don't need to be concerned about your AFib. You know, of the things that you need to worry about, AFib is way down here. And he reaches his hand down and almost touches the floor. Well, the patient is saying, Doc, it's obvious that you haven't had what it does to you. And unfortunately, that's all too common a response from doctors. They really can't understand because they haven't experienced it.
Mm-hmm.
So part of my mission is really to help doctors understand more about what AFib does to patients. What is the psychological impact that it has, as well as the physical impact? So often I hear AFib patients saying, my doctor told me I was just a hysterical female. And, you know, we hear that for other things as well.
We do, and it's unfortunate that women's heart issues are often dismissed as being hormonal or emotional or, you know, a panic attack or whatever, and our symptoms are not taken seriously.
Absolutely. I think part of that is that we women tend to open up more about our feelings and about what our condition is doing to us. And many doctors, you know, tend to be the very logical left brain kinds of folks. They're not as emotional, and they really don't know how to deal with our expression of emotions. So when I hear someone say, you know, my doctor just said I'm a hysterical female, that's when you have two choices. You can either become very logical in explaining to your doctor what's going on and try not to be emotional about it, or you can find another doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the latter is the better of those approaches, because if your doctor's saying you're just a hysterical female and not really taking you seriously, can your doctor really give you the best treatment for you? It's got to be a partnership. It's got to be a two-way street. And if you're not, if you don't have mutual respect, mutual communication, you're not going to optimize the kind of treatment that you need. And that's why maybe it's better just, you know, to really say, okay, next, you'll find a better doctor.
Sure. Well, let's talk a little bit about how you treat it, because you're not necessarily doomed to have this happen to you at any given moment. There are things that you can do about it, aren't there?
Absolutely. And, you know, at this point, I think it'd be really good for if Patty could share her story, because hers is a really great story of, you know, how she was diagnosed and what her doctor told her to do about it. Patty, are you there?
I sure am. I sure am. And I'm happy to share what happened with me.
Right.
It was about 2.5 years ago when I was 48, 49, and I went into the doctor just for a routine checkup. And it just so happened that she was raring to practice being a doctor, and he gave me about 3 times the normal time that a doctor usually gives you. And he kept listening to my heartbeat and didn't look too happy and said to me, I'd like your doctor to listen to this too. And I thought, oh boy, just the overactive intern trying to find something wrong with me. And so my doctor came into the room, listened to my heartbeat, frowned at me and said, you have an irregular heartbeat. Now, at the time, ironically, I was working for the American Heart Association, and even though I knew how common an irregular heartbeat was, I promptly looked at her and said, no, I don't. Once she convinced me that I did, she very promptly hooked me up to an EKG, like you said, and said indeed that it was an irregular heartbeat and that she was going to send me to an electrophysiologist. So I did go to an electrophysiologist who very quickly diagnosed that I had atrial fibrillation. And he certainly was very good at what he did. He also had a partner at the Cleveland Clinic who he was talking to about my case. He put me on a Holter monitor for a month, and I did exactly, Melanie, what you described as far as pressing the button when I felt something interesting going on. I felt AFib so often, and the easiest place for me to take my pulse is my neck, for me to really feel what my heart is doing. And I thought I was going to have permanent indentations in my neck from my fingers being there. So I actually would alternate sides, thinking, if nothing else, I'm going to get an old lady neck before my time, feeling my AFib. And my kids, who at the time were about 11 and 13, were fascinated with the Holter and how I called in things. But then, of course, when the Holter is talking, so to speak, to the telephone, it makes a very loud noise. And that was actually interrupting the kids' TV. So it was fun for and then it wasn't fun anymore. But they, you know, we'd be sitting and watching TV, and I think my face would get animated, and I'd say, oh, I think I'm having a good one. Game, of course, but it was quite interesting. So during this time, the readings were going into the electrophysiologist. He was consulting with the Cleveland Clinic doc, and he was very close to giving me an ablation or suggesting that I get an ablation done. When they came to the conclusion, after really looking at these tapes, and I guess I'm in a couple of medical journals because of the uniqueness of what happened to me for whatever reason, but he came to the conclusion that my AFib was occurring because of my high blood pressure, because of my hypertension. And he was quite sure of the fact that if they could really get my hypertension under ultra control, that the AFib would stop. So he told me very promptly to lose weight, to start exercising, that I could have absolutely no caffeine at all. And this was 3 weeks before Easter, where I already had the chocolate purchased and given it out. Sigh. But I managed to acquiesce and lost the weight, exercise like a fool. You know, there's nothing like the motivation of your own health to get you moving. And so all of that occurred. And what ended up happening with me was the morning after I started taking my third hypertensive medication, the atrial fibrillation stopped, and it's never started again.
That's
so awesome. That has been my story. It certainly was an interesting time with that Holter monitor. There was a point at which my doctor called me because she was concerned. Atrial fibrillation is, as Melanie described, that unique. And your heart is in atrial fib, and it is beating over 300 times a minute. It's called atrial flutter, which my heart went into quite often, although I didn't realize it, and I didn't have any adverse effects like lightheadedness or anything like that. So I think I was quite fortunate, or perhaps I just wasn't observant enough to really realize what was going on with me. But indeed, very fortunately, knock on wood, that it remains. I have been symptom-free with being a good girl and exercising and doing all the good stuff. And, of course, I think primarily taking those three hypertensive medications.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so,
and Patty has done an amazing job of altering her lifestyle, which is not something everyone is able to do, to have the stamina and the willpower to do. So she deserves a lot of credit.
Absolutely. That is awesome, Patty. You mentioned the three hypertension drugs. I know that you're on a beta blocker. What are the other medications?
You know, and I wish I could remember what types they were, but I know that I take Altase, which is one of them, and I don't know if you would know offhand what type of a med that is. As I said, I used to know, and don't know anymore. The second one is Cardizem BD, and then the third one is Toprol XL.
Right, okay. And the Toprol XL is a beta blocker. The Cardizem is actually, and the beta blocker is actually for controlling the heart's rate. The Cardizem is actually for controlling the heart rhythm, if I remember, you know, accurately. It is really for, it's for controlling the heart rhythm. The other thing that you didn't mention, which is not really for hypertension, but you're on Coumadin as well.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Coumadin.
You know, it's to me what it feels like, and perhaps by the time I'm done with the session tonight, I'll think differently, but what I've resigned myself to is that it is a necessary evil. I was actually at a Heart Association meeting where the latest and greatest was being presented on everything that someone who is being admitted into a hospital for quality control needs to have done, depending on what their symptoms are. And the latest stats of about 8 months ago was that if someone is experiencing atrial fibrillation or has experienced it, if they take Coumadin at the proper dosage and have their blood under proper control as far as how thin and thick it is, you have a 72% less likelihood of having a stroke. And I can't tell you that number 72% was branded into my brain and has been ever since then. And I have been fortunate in that I have found it quite easy to control.
That's great.
So I have been lucky. I go to a state-of-the-art hospital that I believe might have the latest and greatest in the ways that my blood is taken, and it's minimally invasive. And they are so proactive in what they do to partner with me, to help me with that. And outside of, I recently had pneumonia, and I was on a steroid and an antibiotic. And boy, oh boy, did that make things wacky. And it has taken up to about 2 months to totally get it under control, although after about a month, the numbers were pretty much back to where they should have been. So, you know, it's unfortunate. I don't have excessive bruising or any of the things that I know that many people have trouble with. So,
which we discussed all last month.
Exactly. I think I've just been a lucky duck, and I think my peasant Polish body just isn't sophisticated enough to deal with some of this stuff. So,
well, and we'll be doing we'll be doing a separate call too on a home INR testing setup that I know we kind of fantasized about how it would be to manage being on Coumadin or warfarin like you manage being on insulin. And I'm very interested to find out more about that because I think that would be something that would be a huge quality of life issue.
Absolutely.
For women who are, warfarin or Coumadin is a hard drug to live on. But anything that we can do to make a woman feel empowered about having control over that would be excellent.
Absolutely. And so, Liz, you alluded to the call that we did last month.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyone that's listening and that wants to know more about Coumadin and issues with Coumadin, managing Coumadin, and so forth, should check out that call. So you asked me about how does one treat and manage their atrial fibrillation.
Right.
So let me. There are really two major avenues initially. There's diet and there's medication. And because we've been talking about medication with Patty's situation, let me talk a little more about medication, and then we'll jump back to diet in a moment.
All right.
So there are really a couple of goals for managing atrial fibrillation with medication. The first is really to control the heart rate, is to manage the risk of strokes, and that's with the anticoagulation. So first of all, typically a doctor will say, I'm going to put you on a drug to either control the heart rate, which is called rate control, or to control the heart rhythm, which is rhythm control. Typically, the rate control is done with things like your beta blockers.
Mm-hmm.
It's done with... typically the first line of defense there is going to be a beta blocker. It's typically like a toprol or a atenolol or perhaps a sotalol. It's sometimes done with a calcium channel blocker. Actually, come to think of it, I said that cardizem was an antiarrhythmic. It's actually a heart rate regulator. It's a calcium channel blocker. So it's done with like a cardizem or a verapamil. And sometimes, for controlling the heart rate, they'll give you a cardiac glycoside such as digoxin or linoxin. So that's typically the first line of control these days, is to focus on controlling the heart's rate. In other words, to slow down the heart so it's not working so hard when you're having atrial fibrillation.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that works especially well when you're having episodes of it, when you're having atrial fibrillation all the time. That's a condition called persistent atrial fibrillation, when you're having it all the time. For some people, it's what's called paroxysmal atrial fibrillation. That's where it comes and goes. You may have an episode, and then it stops. You have another episode, and then it stops. So a lot of times, doctors will not give you the daily heart rate control medication. They'll just say, do what's called pill in a pocket. If you have an incident of AFib, just take one of your pills. If that one doesn't get it under control, take a second one. If that one doesn't get it under control, call me. Having pill in the pocket approach.
When you have the sort of intermittent atrial fibrillation,
exactly,
as opposed to the constant.
When it's more intermittent. So typically, you can do a pill in the pocket approach with rate control to slow down the heart's rate, or with the rhythm control. The rhythm control is typically a sodium channel blocker or a potassium channel blocker. Examples of sodium channel blockers are things like you may have heard of Rhythmol or Tambacor or Quinidine. Potassium channel blockers are things like amiodarone or Sotalol. Now, amiodarone is a really nasty drug. One patient told me that his pharmacist said, you really don't want to stay on amiodarone that long because if you do, you'll turn blue like a Smurf.
No.
That's a real attractive side effect. So the challenge with medication is that sometimes the side effects can be just as bad as the condition.
Well,
so,
I know we have a whole call next month talking about living on the beta blocker.
Absolutely. And beta blockers are actually considered to be less of a problem, less risky, less toxic than the rhythm control medications, the antiarrhythmics.
Really?
Yeah, beta blockers are considered very benign in comparison to antiarrhythmics. So, you know, it's
maybe we need to talk about that too.
Absolutely. So, you know, some of the things that can happen. So, for example, I mentioned with, you know, amiodarone as an antiarrhythmic that can cause you to turn blue. It can also cause lung toxicity. So often it's really the medication of any of the other medications. So typically the antiarrhythmics, the rhythm control drugs, can be much more difficult. And in most cases, they're only about 50% effective as well. So that's not real encouraging. So medication can be a problem. And even when you're on one or the other, either rate control or rhythm control, you still need to take the anticoagulation. You know, all the rat poison jokes aside, anticoagulation is a really important part of managing your atrial fibrillation because of the fact that, you know, as we just said, about a third of atrial fibrillation patients will have a stroke at some point. So the purpose of taking an anticoagulant like Coumadin is to avoid those strokes. So that's really, really important. So medication is really kind of a first line of control by doctors. Now, that's what they're going to try. If that doesn't work, they will go on to something else. But one of the things that many patients are starting to learn is that diet can make a real big difference as well. And I want to give you a resource. It's called, it's basically Hans Larsen's Lone Atrial Fibrillation Bulletin Board. And it's at afibers.org. AFIBERS. Absolutely. And the reason that I'm sending you there is if you're interested in controlling atrial fibrillation via diet, there are a lot of folks that are regular posters to that bulletin board. We're very focused on diet. Really, the whole bulletin board is focused on diet as a means of controlling lone atrial fibrillation. And lone atrial fibrillation means when you don't have any other structural heart disease, you simply have atrial fibrillation. But the things that they are learning could also impact those who have heart disease and atrial fibrillation. So it's a really good resource to follow. Some of the things that have been learned are certainly the role of magnesium and potassium and other supplements in helping to control atrial fibrillation. So there are things like taurine, ribose, and lots more supplements that can certainly have an impact on your atrial fibrillation. Also, there's a lot of discussion there of the paleo diet. And so a lot of people on that bulletin board have had success with diet in controlling their lone atrial fibrillation. So, you know, it's a good resource, particularly anything posted by a woman named Jackie. Jackie just flat, she has a dental background, and she digs in like crazy and posts some of the most incredible posts. So diet is one way to potentially manage your atrial fibrillation. That's a great resource. I'm not going to reinvent the wheel by, putting a lot of the diet stuff up on stopafib.org. Mm-hmm. Talk about medication, talk about other ways of managing to learn more about different options.
Fantastic.
So, that then leaves...
You had mentioned, though, that the women have more side effects of the medication.
You're right. And thank you for bringing me back to that. There was actually a great study that was released about maybe a week or so ago. It was done at the European Society of Cardiology. And in that study, they found that women really, it's more difficult to treat women for heart disease. And a lot of it has to do with us having smaller blood vessels and so forth. But when it comes to medication, women are much harder to treat as well because we tend to have more side effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was really one of the early studies to point out that the things that work for men don't always work for women, particularly in the medication realm. One of the things that they're postulating is that it may be related to our hormones.
Well, of course, we're so underrepresented in any clinical studies, but you know, the information just isn't there either.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So we know from research that our hormones, particularly estrogen, can manage to cause us to feel pain more acutely. As a result, I think it also perhaps exacerbates our stress response. Well, that same estrogen apparently can get in there and interfere with the medications we're taking. And that can explain why sometimes the things that work for men don't work for women when it comes to the medication. And that opens up really a whole area of dialogue that we need to be able to have with our doctors.
Sure.
If our medication is not working, we need to be discussing it with our doctors. Just because it works for men, it works, and it's time to try something else.
Right, and you had said that, you know, so much of AFib is an experiment of one. What works for another woman may not work for you either. Is that the
Absolutely. Is
that true?
Absolutely. And one of the things that I meant to mention when we were talking about, you know, some of the triggers and causes was that there are really a couple of different categories that we're finding of atrial fibrillation. There is the category that is really more stress and exercise induced, and the people that have that as a trigger tend to have their atrial fibrillation during the daytime. That tends to be more adrenaline associated, and that's associated typically with the faster heart rate. There's also a smaller subset of AFib patients that have a kind that's called vagal AFib. And in that particular case, that's more related to the gut, which is also related to when you go into AFib, your heart rate slows down. And so that can actually be brought on by sleeping or by eating, particularly eating late at night. And so when you're digesting or when you're sleeping, that's when you go into AFib. So that's more associated with nighttime. And it's been found that those who have the vagal form of AFib tend to not do well with beta blockers. Beta blockers can actually exacerbate situation. So, you know, just like we can see differences in, you know, types of responses to, we can also see some of that in the things that, you know, are more male-female related. The vagal tends to be a more male thing. A lot of times men that love to exercise will tend to have, their situation will be such that they love to exercise. They can actually run off their AFib episode by doing more exercise. So
really?
So we see things all across the board. So the types of medication are different. The types of AFib are different. The types of triggers are different. And then when you think about women, the time of the month could make a huge difference. You know, what's your level of hormones in your body? Does it work for you some times of the month and not others? So there are a lot of things that we really, you know, should think about and need to explore with our doctors. We need to better educate our doctors about what's going on in our own individual situation. And while, you know, cardiologists are often really good in helping us treat our atrial fibrillation, a lot of times it really takes going to a specialist, to an electrophysiologist, who's a special cardiologist who's focused on treating just heart rhythm. And so often they will see more of the variations than a cardiologist will and can perhaps help come up with a program that can, you know, work better for us as individuals.
So what happens, though, if the medication's not working for you or you just plain can't tolerate the side effects? Or, and I know you had a horrible time trying to manage being on Coumadin.
Oh, absolutely.
So
absolutely.
What happens?
Well, you know, let's talk about, you know, what, you know, first the, you know, what happens if you can't, if you can't get stable, and the situation in a moment. With medication, you're going through what's called chemical or drug cardioversion. And the cardioversion means converting your heart rhythm from an abnormal rhythm to a normal rhythm, or what we call normal sinus rhythm. Well, if the drugs aren't working to do that, and let's say you're in persistent AFib and you just can't seem to get it to stop, a lot of times when you go to the emergency room, they'll do what's called an electrical cardioversion. That's where they basically shock the heart back into normal sinus rhythm. And that tends to stick you back in normal sinus rhythm, but it doesn't last forever. For some people, it may last for a few hours. For others, it may last months. But after you've had multiple cardioversions and it doesn't seem to last, that's when it's time that maybe you want to consider some of the other kinds of procedures. There are surgical procedures, and there are what we call catheter ablation procedures. So a catheter ablation is something that typically is done by an electrophysiologist in an electrophysiology lab. Then there are the surgeries, like a surgical ablation that's done by a surgeon in the actual operating room. So let's talk first about the catheter ablation. First, the electrophysiologist has probably been treating you with medications and with the anticoagulants. In that case, he or she is probably going to recommend, like Patty, in your case, they thought that catheter ablation, since an EP does catheter ablations, that's usually going to be a next step that's recommended. Hmm. In my particular case, I considered a catheter ablation, and for me it was not the right choice. That was several years ago. It's getting to be a better choice now.
Mm-hmm.
Catheter ablation is when they go in, just like in a catheterization, when you actually, when they go into, through the through your leg, through the,
In your groin.
In your groin, and then they thread the catheter up to your heart. That's what they're doing with the catheter ablation. And then they go in, and they actually will use a device to create what's called a conduction block. It's what actually stops the erratic electrical signals from coming in from the top of the heart, from the pulmonary veins, into the atrium, into the upper chambers of the heart. And so by actually making a physical separation electrically between those two, they can actually cut off those strange electrical signals coming in. That works really well for some people, doesn't work for everyone. And the reason that I chose not to go that route is at the time, a couple of years ago, the success rates weren't all that high.
Mm-hmm.
They were with folks who were having paroxysmal, in other words, off and on atrial fibrillation. The range was typically around 60% of those were solved with a catheter ablation, with a first catheter ablation. In some people, they had to go to a second catheter ablation, and in some cases, even thirds. 60% was about the average. But some electrophysiologists were as low as 16. 18%, 38% for others, 22% for some. A lot of it depended on whether it was the paroxysmal atrial fibrillation or whether it was persistent, whether it was mm-hmm. happening all the time. But even at that, those success rates seem to me to be fairly low at risk with that. Now, a lot of progress has been made in atrial fibrillation. Is we're finding the catheter ablation for atrial fibrillation is a much higher success rate.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, there have been some studies recently that are finding that sometimes there's what's called electrical reconnection. That means that where they put in those blocks grows back together. Basically, the electrical system reconnects itself. And that can happen in as little as 4 to 5 months. And that's part of what's causing people to have 2 and 3
sure.
catheter ablations. In my own situation, I was having difficulty with the Coumadin. I found that I could never really be stable on the Coumadin. And I read a study 2 years ago that said about a fourth of Coumadin patients are never going to be stable on Coumadin. And as a result, I knew, and it was because of genetic reasons. There are a couple of genes that can actually interfere with the processing of Coumadin. And so as a result, I knew that I couldn't let that nightmare continue the rest of my life. So I started doing some research. The catheter ablation for me was not the right answer. You know, for a lot of people, it is. What I discovered was there's what's called a surgical ablation. It can either be done open heart surgery, or it can be done minimally invasively, which is where they cut just a few incisions under your arm on each side. So it's three incisions on each side under your arm. And they go in, they use basically a little robot vision kind of tool. It's called an endoscope. And it allows them to actually see the heart. Then those incisions allow them to stick in their instruments and to stick in the device that actually creates the conduction block. So they go in and they actually create a conduction block. They remove the left atrial appendage, which is thought to be responsible for about 90% of the blood clots that cause strokes. And by removing that, they cut down your risk of having a stroke later. So for me, that sounded like a really good way to go. So I went and talked to the doctor.
Well, and they gave you your life back in a lot of ways.
It absolutely did. I talked to the doctor. For me, it was a no-brainer. 10 days later, I was in surgery. And this surgery, it's minimally invasive, but it is still surgery. So there's anesthesia, healing. There's a lot there. But it gave me my life back. In contrast to going the open heart way, and the open heart way works really well if you have other things that need to be done, such as we have another caller who mentioned that she had an aortic valve replacement. When they're going in to do that kind of surgery, it's really easy for them to treat atrial fibrillation while you're in there. And so, it's the kind of thing that makes a lot of sense if you need multiple things done. But the recovery period is much longer. That can be 6 to 8 weeks. You may have to stay in the hospital a week. With the minimally invasive that I had, I was in the hospital 2 to 3 days, recovery a couple of weeks. So it's a lot easier on the body. So that is what gave me my life back and has made a huge difference for me. But it's individual. For some people, surgery is not the right thing. For others, it is.
Sure. And, well, as we keep noticing about this particular condition, that it does seem to be a very individualized condition.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, can we take a moment? We have Jane from California on.
She left us.
Oh, okay.
Jane, are you still there?
Okay, so she mentioned that she had had the aortic valve replacement done. When you go in to, just have all the things done, that you need to have done to cure your atrial fibrillation, and so that's really a great way to go as well.
Sure. Now, I know that there are some particular to women issues with both the catheter ablation and the surgical options, and maybe we could talk about those. Because, of course, as you said, our hormones mess with the medication. We certainly talked about how much fun it can be to have your period on a blood thinner last month. There's a lot of implications that are unique to women that doctors may not necessarily be aware of or very familiar with because they don't think about it.
Exactly. And that is a real issue for women, and they don't think about it, so they don't tell us beforehand.
It would nice to know some of these things.
Oh, yes. And so I experienced those, and I've talked with other female patients who did. And so that's one of the messages that I deliver when I'm talking with surgeons. They need to know about what are the things that they need to caution women about. So, one of the things, for men, it's still painful. There's a lot of pain in that area. It's fairly sensitive under your arms. But for women, it's a really sensitive area. And, I had no qualms about it. I was glad I did it. But it's important to know that that is a sensitive area. You're going to have some sensitivity. It's a really good idea to buy some soft bras before you go in for surgery, because they're going to, you know, they're going to be a whole lot more comfortable than, you know, a regular bra that could scratch those and rub those incisions. So, you know, that's one of the things.
Well, if you're having the open procedure in a surgery, you just need a different bra, totally. Because
absolutely.
Once they open the chest, it never goes back to be the same band size again. You're going to move up a band size, and if you try to strap that thing on, oh my, that's uncomfortable.
Oh,
and
yes.
It's just, you need to find a way to make that a more comfortable thing, and it would be so much nicer to know beforehand that, you know, go out and buy a bra without underwires that has a soft band that maybe closes in the front. Because if you've had an open chest procedure, reaching around there, it's not happening.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's so important. And when you have incisions around the bra area, you're going to get rubbing.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to have bleeding. So it's important to know to perhaps have some extra, some big gauze pads, the big bandages, the kinds of things that you need to not only protect that incision from the bra, but also to protect your bra and your clothes from bleed through.
Right.
So that's
isn't that embarrassing?
Thing. Absolutely. And so one of the things that was a challenge for me after surgery, when I had to get dressed up in my really good clothes, was how do I keep from having bleeding come through and ruin my expensive clothes?
Right.
So when I'm up on stage, I don't need that problem. And so, the things, you know, it's appropriate to think through that before you actually go in for surgery so that you have those supplies and you're prepared.
Right,
so
absolutely.
So it's really important to know that. And then, what about a mammogram? Is that going to feel really, really comfortable after having surgery in that area? I don't think so.
No, but it becomes more important because anytime you've had surgery in the chest, now you have scar tissue.
Absolutely.
And that could absolutely mask a lump. So you need to be even more consistent with your mammograms and make sure that you, even if you're not of age for, I need it anyway.
Absolutely. So knowing that beforehand, it's probably a good idea to go ahead and have that mammogram before your surgery.
Mm-hmm.
You have, a good baseline, but it also means that you can put off the next one longer.
Now that's smart.
The thought of having to deal with a mammogram within, 3 to 6 months after the surgery is frightening.
Oh, that's brilliant.
So it's a good idea to have that beforehand.
And then you
so
have 12 months.
So you can take your 12 months, let yourself heal, get more, get the scars and the sensitivity more, dealt with before you have to
that's
have that
brilliant.
Next one. And, I've told you before, Eliz, it was I went for a mammogram not too long ago.
Mm-hmm.
And after having had the surgery, a mammogram is a lot, more uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You get used to that. And had to go right straight from there to my cardiologist visit, and they took my blood pressure, and you know what? It was a little high. Big surprise.
So maybe
that's the kind of thing you want to kind of reverse too, if you're thinking about
your
having
blood
the mammogram.
Taken
have
first.
Your blood pressure checked beforehand, not after.
Absolutely.
So there are unique things with women and things to really just kind of think through, what's the sequence of stuff that you need to do and what are the things you need to do beforehand. And if doctors knew more about that, they could better prepare us.
Absolutely.
That's part of the reason that I put a special page on stopafib.org that's specifically for women having the surgery.
Well, and even with the catheterization, I'm sorry, one of the most embarrassing things you can have happen is be strapped to that table and then have somebody shave you down there.
Yes.
It's like, tell me that's going to happen. I'll go get the bikini wax.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I'd much rather go take care of that myself. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Plus they're going to use that nasty razor and you're going to get
absolutely.
It'd be much better to be able to say to a woman, you know, guess what? You're going to need to, you know, take a little trip to the spa, get it taken care of, have a good experience.
Mm-hmm.
Having the attendant do it is not going to be good.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. There are a lot of unique things that we women need to think about beforehand.
True.
So,
and a lot of things are so much easier to deal with if you just know that they're coming.
Exactly.
As opposed to being surprised by them.
Absolutely.
So, well, we are over time. And
yes.
As always, because we can always talk. That's never a problem. Does anybody have any questions before we sign off? And
before we sign off, I would like to mention some resources. But,
absolutely.
Let's definitely, you know, see what questions there might be.
Anybody have any? No? Well, as always, Melanie, you have done an incredible job of giving us great information in a way that is easily understood.
Thank you.
One of the wonderful things about our relationship is that acting as the healthcare interpreter is always a great benefit to all of us. So I thank you so much for being a part of this call. And please, yes, do give all the wonderful resources that you have. And I know that you have them on your website, and I will also put them on mine so that people will have very good access to them.
Okay, that sounds great. At stopafib.org, there is on the right navigation, there is a topic called patient and caregiver resources, and that's because you really can never have too much good information. There's a lot of health information out there, but a lot of it is not really credible.
Mm-hmm.
So I list a lot of resources that can help you in addition to stopafib.org. You know, there are atrial fibrillation, cardiac arrhythmia, heart and stroke resources such as American Heart Association, American Stroke Association, some other AFib patient sites, College of Cardiology, Cleveland Clinic, Heart Rhythm Society, Medline, lots of great resources out there.
Well, and Medline was one you shared last time, and I had not been familiar with it. That is a wonderful resource.
It absolutely is. And WebMD is a great one as well. So there's a section here for medications. WebMD is one of those resources. Drug Digest, Drug Information Online, Medline Plus for drugs and supplements. A lot of great information for learning about medications that you're on, as well as any drug interactions that there may be.
Mm-hmm.
And then another resource that's here is discussion groups. And there are four major discussion groups, depending on what types of things you're interested in. There's the lone atrial fibrillation that I mentioned earlier. That's for those who don't have any underlying structural heart disease accompanying their AFib, and it's really focused a lot on diet and natural ways to control atrial fibrillation. There's another one that's the AFib support group. It's a little more general. There's AFib cures, which is for those who are interested in or have had procedures such as the Mays surgical ablation or the mini Mays surgical ablation that I had. Also applies to catheter ablations. And then there's another one that's really more general support of AFib. It's more conversational, and it's the P atrial fib support group. A lot of good resources out there. Also go to the news and events section of the stopafib.org site. Lots of press releases, articles, things like the Heart Rhythm Society consensus report on atrial fibrillation treatment. Wonderful report, probably one of the most important pieces of information that's out there. That consensus report is there. The American Heart Association guidelines for treating atrial, wonderful audio from last month's patient's perspective session.
And hopefully this audio when I get finished.
Women living on blood thinners. So there's a link to that as well. So a lot of great resources under the AFib News and Events and the Patient Caregiver Resources section of stopafib.org.
Wonderful. Well, Melanie, again, thank you for the work that you do. And you're definitely making a difference in what people understand about AFib and how people are treated by educating doctors. So thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the opportunity to share this.
Oh, this has been a wonderful conversation. Patty, thank you for sharing your story.
Patty, thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So next month we will be talking about the beta blocker stupids, or how it is living on beta blockers. And we have some other wonderful things coming up in the future as well. If you're listening to this and you want more, you can visit the Embrace Your Heart Wellness Initiative website at www.embraceyourheart.com. Again, Melanie and Patty, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And until next time, wish you good health.
Thanks so much. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.